We simply can't afford the number of buildings we have in this state, and that's why you'll never catch up on deferred maintenance with what we have right now.
Lawmakers grapple with a growing list of maintenance needs for state-owned buildings. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, April 21st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a new book mixes Alaskan wilderness adventures with concern over human-caused impacts to the natural world.
Which of these great unconformities is going to win out in the end? Is it the disruptive great unconformity, or is it the creative great unconformity?
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
A tugboat with more than 300 gallons of oil aboard sank last night in Sitka. The tug, owned by Sampson Tug and Barge, sank near its dock in Stargaven Bay. According to divers from Hansen Maritime Company, the tug Powhatan had drifted offshore and was found around 10:15 p.m., The divers estimate the Powhatan was 60 feet below its resting location. On board was 325 gallons of lube oil, 12 gallons of diesel, and possible sludge. It's not known how much oil was spilled into the water. The U.S. Coast Guard, Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, and the Southeast Petroleum Response Organization responded to the scene, surrounding the tug with booms to contain the oil. The response team is monitoring impacts to wildlife, but no incidents have been detected so far. According to the state's situation report, an underwater camera may be used to confirm the tug's location and monitor for fuel leakage. A seafood processing plant in Unalaska is on the hook for $3.2 million for breaking air pollution regulations. The settlement reached yesterday with the Environmental Protection Agency comes 8 years after employees at Westward Seafoods turned off air pollution controls and falsified records to cover their tracks. Westward is required to install a new electronic monitoring system, and $1 million will be spent on air pollution reduction. Four Point Hope men have been sentenced for the 2015 illegal killing and waste of walruses on the Arctic Slope. The announcement came yesterday from the U.S. Attorney's Office. Adam Sage, Jacob Lane, Guy Tuzroylak, and Michael Tuzroylak Jr. were charged with violating the Marine Mammal Protection Act. The men made two trips to Cape Lisburn on the Chukchi Sea coast in September 2015. They illegally shot and killed several walruses at a haulout. They then salvaged only the animals' ivory tusks, leaving the carcasses to waste. The men were sentenced to 3 years probation. They also have to pay $1,000 restitution to be used for walrus conservation projects on refuges. They must perform 500 hours of community service and lead presentations on hunting ethics in Point Hope and nearby villages. They are not allowed to hunt walrus for 1 year, but they must hunt for the subsistence needs of elders in the community. They will also have to apologize to local leaders for their actions. As lawmakers debate how to pay for the state budget for this year and into the future, there is a growing problem. There are nearly $2 billion in maintenance to state-owned facilities that has been put off. Lawmakers would like to see the state develop a plan to sell off buildings to reduce the long-term cost of maintaining them. Soldotna Republican Senator Peter Michicki said during a hearing on Wednesday that the state's history of more construction when oil prices are high has left the state with too many buildings.
So we keep building, but we don't determine whether or not we can afford those buildings. And that's what gets us in this position. So we simply can't afford the number of buildings we have in this state, and that's why you'll never catch up on deferred maintenance with what we have right now.
More than half of the deferred maintenance cost is for University of Alaska buildings. The second largest category is Department of Transportation and Public Facilities properties. Eagle River Republican Senator Anna McKinnon says the state should consider closing facilities in some rural areas. She cited as an example three villages near Nightmute in western Alaska.
Three different schools, three different airports, three different maintenance stations, which is something that, from the state's perspective right now, is difficult to justify or sustain.
The deferred maintenance problem shrank in the past decade due to a five-year capital project under former Governor Sean Parnell's administration. Fairbanks Senator Click Bishop says he'd like to see the state continue to push the amount of deferred maintenance down.
It's important, so we won't blow up the budget when we come into times of having some extra funds, because we're consistent. And that's the key word, being consistent.
Governor Bill Walker cited the deferred maintenance on Tuesday in pitching his case for why the legislature should pass a long-term plan to balance the budget. The U.S. military says Russian military aircraft have approached the coast of Alaska four times this week, and U.S. fighter jets intercepted them twice. The military says the latest incident happened late Thursday night, last night, and that F-22 Raptor aircraft and Canadian CF-18 Hornet fighters safely intercepted two Russian Tu-95 Bear bombers. Lori O'Donnelly is a spokeswoman for the North American Aerospace Defense Command. She says the incidents all happened in international airspace. Russia periodically flies into the U.S. Air Defense Identification Zone that extends 200 miles off the coast. O'Donnelly says the last such string of incidents was in 2014. The incidents come amid heightened U.S.-Russia tensions over the civil war in Syria. North American Aerospace Defense Command is a U.S.-Canada organization that monitors approaches to North America and defends the airspace. A wildfire is burning in a remote area of northwest Alaska. The Alaska Fire Service reports that the Zane Hills Fire was discovered this week and mapped at 1,900 acres. AFS spokeswoman Beth Ibsen says the fire, burning in a snow-free area of tundra in the Selawik National Wildlife Refuge, was spotted by AFS staff flying to the village of Norvik for training.
They saw smoke, flew over it, kind of sized it up a little bit. It was just creeping. It wasn't doing too much. And they made note that it was an area that was kind of surrounded by snow.
Ibsen says the fire is suspected to be human-caused, as snow machine tracks were spotted in the surrounding area. Although the fire is not threatening anything and is expected to burn itself out, Ibsen says it provides warning that fire season is beginning. She says that's true even around Fairbanks, where despite above-normal snow, spring is revealing fire-prone vegetation.
Almost like it freeze-dried in some places. So the grass that's exposed right now is really dry.
Ibsen says spring is a challenging time for wildfire managers as they are still bringing together resources. She says smoke jumpers are available to do initial attack on fires that spring up. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, scientists plan for a nationwide march to raise awareness.
It almost feels like it can't not be political at this point. Like we're kind of stuck in this moment where science has to be politicized and you have to sort of pick what you stand for.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
In coming decades, researchers predict climate change could displace millions of people across the country as rising sea levels and erosion hit coastal communities. And as policymakers start to grapple with that reality, there's a specific phrase making the rounds: managed retreat. In other words, relocating whole neighborhoods or communities and retreating from the coast. A new study looks at examples around the world, including some in Alaska. Rachel Waldholz of Alaska's Energy Desk has more.
The Netherlands is famous for its ability to make land from water. The country has a mind-boggling system of dikes and levees that drain and protect coastal areas. But in recent years, the country has been lowering some of those levees and allowing some communities to flood.
The purpose of that was by absorbing all of that water upstream, there are larger towns downstream that would be much safer in the case of these high river flows.
That's Miyuki Hino. She's a researcher at Stanford University. Her team looked at 27 examples around the world of people moving because of environmental changes. They range from the decision not to rebuild in areas hit by the tsunami in Sri Lanka, to abandoning sinking land in Louisiana, to eroding coastal villages in Alaska. One of the most successful examples is the Dutch program. It's called Room for the River. And it's about, well, making room for the river, stepping back, retreating from flood zones. Hino says her team found two important factors in every example they studied. Number one, does the community in question want to move?
And the other was whether broader society beyond the residents really benefited from retreat taking place.
In other words, the move was most likely to happen and most likely to satisfy most of the people involved when the residents themselves wanted to move and the broader government agreed. And that was most likely to happen when there were clear benefits to people outside the directly affected community. But in Alaska, Hino says that's been a challenge. Villages like Nutak, Shishmaref, and Kivalina have been trying to move for years, but neither the state nor Congress nor federal agencies have mustered the funding to help them.
There's a perception that broader society does not significantly benefit from retreat taking place, and as a result, it's a major struggle to get the necessary government support to do so.
But Robin Bronin says that interpretation, it's not quite right.
They talk about that scenario as a lack of political will, which is not what I would say.
Bronin runs the Alaska Institute for Justice. She's studied efforts to relocate coastal villages for the last decade. And she argues the problem in Alaska hasn't been a lack of political will. State and federal agencies have been trying to help villages relocate. She says the problem is we don't have the right laws.
Which means that government agencies don't have mandate or funding to make it possible to actually implement what everybody agrees is the best long-term adaptation strategy.
For instance, U.S. disaster laws will pay to help individual families move after a major hurricane, but they can't help a whole community relocate in the face of slow-moving erosion or sea level rise. That was proved most recently this winter, when the village of Nutak requested a presidential disaster declaration and was turned down. Both Bronin and Hino agree on one thing. As Hino says,
it seems very likely that people will be on the move in a changing climate, and the question is how.
Will we beat a hasty retreat and leave some people behind? Or will it be something more managed? From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Rachel Waltholz in Anchorage.
In a new memoir, Alaskan author Kate Troll tackles the issue of conservation and climate change. The book is called The Great Unconformity: Reflections on Hope in an Imperiled World. She says the unusual title comes from a geological point of interest she discovered on a 27-day raft trip in the Grand Canyon.
There's this amazing gap in time where you have 1.1 billion years that are missing between these layers of rock. And the whole notion of being able to put my hand on both sides of these layers and hold the equivalent of a billion years between my hands really resonated with me in terms of the power of our imagination and creativity, what we as mankind have done in terms of being a creative force. But at the same time, the great unconformity in my mind also represents mankind in that we are a species that is now impacting the natural system. We are, just by our very nature, an evolutionary force. So my question that I pose in this book is sort of which of these great unconformities is going to win out in the end? Is it the disruptive great unconformity or is it the creative great unconformity? So I just thought it was a really powerful metaphor to use through my book on sustainability and climate change. Also, it makes you curious, right? What is the great unconformity?
Right. You clearly have great concern for climate change and for mitigation, but you just mentioned and you found hope spots in moving forward. Describe some of what those are.
So some of those hope spots are the fact that we now, renewable energy, particularly wind and solar, now has grid parity with natural gas and coal. In other words, it's now cheaper to switch over to renewable energy. And that reaching grid parity is kind of the equivalent, the difference between ice and water. It doesn't sound like it means a whole lot, but that 1 degree change really opens up the marketplace and creates all kinds of economic incentives. Even though, for an example, you know, Trump made all these changes to bring back these coal jobs, but the world's economy, the clean energy economy, has already moved on.
Kate, is it hard to reach people on the issue of climate change when there seems to be fatigue on the topic, even with people who are concerned about it.
Yes. And I don't want to be all dry and hit you over the head with these statistics. In other words, I'm going to take you on an adventure. So I actually wrap up these policy insights in these seeds of hope in my adventure story. So we're climbing Denali, we're running rivers, we're kayaking among whales. I'm a firm believer that if you have something important to say, if you wrap it up in a story, it tends to stick and resonate better with people.
Kate Troll is the author of a new memoir called The Great Unconformity: Reflections on Hope in an Imperiled World. She's holding a book signing at UAA on Monday, April 24th from 5 to 7, and she's speaking tomorrow at the March for Science in Anchorage. Across the world, scientists are taking part in the March for Science on Saturday. There are 10 marches planned in communities around Alaska, and in the state's largest city, hundreds of people are expected to participate. Zoe Sobel of Alaska's Energy Desk joined a sign-making party at a house in Anchorage and has this story.
Though markers, stencils, and stamps clutter the living room floor, this is no art class.
Brand new markers, all ready to go, just for this occasion.
Days before the March for Science, seven scientists are spending their evening making signs. Their science saves lives, make America smart again, there is no Planet B, and more. The march is billed as a celebration of science. Veronica Padula is a PhD student in marine biology. She says the idea of the march is to increase awareness that science plays a role in everyone's lives, even mine.
The mic in your hand, right? There's science behind the sound that is being collected and recorded from your mic.
After the presidential election, Padula spent 30 days on a ship sailing from Germany to South Africa with graduate students from around the world. A turning point for her was realizing what her instructors meant when they referenced global databases.
Very often, they were accessing data that were collected by NASA or NOAA, organizations that are federal U.S. agencies. And I was like, oh, we're playing a big role here with what we're doing as scientists in the U.S.
Stepping outside her American bubble, she realized other countries take note of what the U.S. does in terms of collecting data or supporting politically charged science topics. And it has international ripple effects. Padula doesn't think science should be political, but with fears of major budget cuts to agencies and of data being wiped from the public record, she feels pushed to be more active.
It's frustrating. It almost feels like it can't not be political at this point. Like we're kind of stuck in this moment where science has to be politicized and you have to sort of pick what you stand for.
Overall, ecologist Kathy Kelsey shares a lot of the same views as Padula, but she's less political.
You know, science is something that politics can't touch and beliefs can't touch. It's just the way we understand the world.
The way Kelsey sees it, science has a process. You ask a question, collect data, and come to a conclusion that's vetted by the scientific community. So when the research is published, she says it shouldn't be undermined because people don't like the conclusion. The March for Science is only the second time Kelsey has joined a rally.
And I think the big thing that has changed for me is moving into an era where I no longer feel like somebody else is going to take care of it, and it in this sense being maintaining high quality scientific information that's available to the public and is respected by the public.
Both Padula and Kelsey are looking beyond this weekend's march. Through education and communication, they want to reach out to non-scientists and expose future generations to the field. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Zoe Sobel in Anchorage.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com. At Alaska Pacific University, students are surrounded by beauty, distinguished faculty, and independent-minded creative students pursuing higher education. AlaskaPacific.edu, moving life forward with APU. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamut.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK, ninjas. What do you get when you mix reality television with an obstacle course? American Ninja Warrior. Now in its ninth season, the show is a glitzy display of human strength that one former competitor has decided to take off the road system. Cody Johnston operates his own ninja training gym in Sitka. KCAW's Emily Kwong visited the facility and has this story.
The only thing standing between this girl and Ninja Warrior glory is a wall that's three times her height.
Hi, my name is Presley Johnston, and I'm 12 years old.
Presley is about to tackle the Warped Wall, the most famous obstacle from American Ninja Warrior. Eyes fixed, arms bent, she sprints directly up the 12-foot slope, pushes off her toes, and reaches upward, just catching the ledge with her fingertips. Grinning, she then kicks her feet away, and her body is now perpendicular to the ground, like a flag on a flagpole, defying gravity.
What I want to see is these kids using their imaginations to overcome obstacles.
This is Presley's dad, Cody Johnston, and this is their family's ninja warrior training gym, Kronos.
My son Chase.
Hello.
Hi. My daughter Riley.
Hi.
And my daughter Presley over there.
Hi. Cody's got three kids in total, and a wife of 18 years, Tara.
We moved to Sitka, and I knew that Sitka was going to be our forever home. So he came to me, and he said, this is what I want to do. And I said, okay, let's find the location.
While Cody teaches classes in cargo shorts, Tara balances the books in 4-inch heels. And their gym is dedicated entirely to workouts that feel like playtime. So instead of treadmills and dumbbells, gym members scale cargo nets, swing from monkey bars, and maneuver obstacles with names like the Devil's Step and Salmon Ladder, all inspired by the famous TV show.
American Ninja Warrior has become a summer phenomenon.
Johnston got hooked in 2013.
I was in Hot Springs, Arkansas.
He was out of the Navy then and studying for a nursing degree.
Wasting away a Saturday, and then I saw a guy jump on this salmon ladder and just started doing these crazy looking pull-ups.
And he's up!
And taking the bar with him up this ladder, I was just amazed. It's like, how can anybody even do that?
That image stuck with him, of a man jumping up a ladder through arm power alone. He and his kids started looking for rocks to climb and scramble across while out hiking, and something clicked.
I think I lost my inner kid somewhere outside the Navy and somewhere in my undergrad degree. I forgot that I was had a kid locked away, and I just reconnected with it.
And his kids were super impressed by what their dad could do.
Hi, I'm Cody. I'm going to be the next American Ninja Warrior.
They insisted he apply for American Ninja Warrior Season 7. Chase, the boy, even made a model ninja course out of Legos, which Cody filmed using stop-motion animation.
Perfection, there he goes, tackling the warped wall, keeping those feet driving up and over like a boss.
Out of thousands of entries, Cody's caught the attention of the producers.
I got a phone call, and they invited me on the show, and all they wanted to talk about was that Lego Ninja Warrior video.
Yeah, I mean, you've done like a tour of Iraq, you're a nurse anesthetist, and your thing, like your gimmick, is Legos.
It's Legos, yeah.
It all comes down to this one jump.
The whole family was invited to watch him compete in a special military edition of American Ninja Warrior. The course was awash in Hollywood lighting, staged in front of a huge battleship with cameras from all angles, former competitors milling about. It was pretty distracting, and when Cody's big moment came, he slipped up on something small.
Well, it looked like he got cocky and stuff. And he went to go run, and he overshot the trampoline, and he buckled his knees and missed the whole cargo net.
If his daughter, that's 15-year-old Riley, sounds disappointed, she's not. In fact, she promptly drew up a new workout routine and encouraged her dad to keep trying.
I know, I'm slipping somewhere.
You need your tigers.
The whole Johnston clan seems to work this way. Like one unit driving each other up the warped wall. And when they fall, to at least make it look cool. It's left an impression on his kids. Here's Chase and Presley.
What's your favorite part about your dad?
Everything.
He's fun, goofy, and he always plays with us now and then. He's just a really good dad.
Ninja Warrior isn't just about the superhuman ability of the contestants. You need to have a good backstory, a reason why you push your body to its fullest potential. And for Cody, this reason is pretty clear.
You know, these kids need something to shoot for in life. Why can't I be the example? I just want to be my kid's superhero. That's how they see me.
And at the end of the day, perhaps being a superhero is even cooler than being a ninja. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Kwong.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week we're hearing from Xavier Love in Anchorage. Love is an aspiring actor from Bartlett High School and also works part-time at a movie theater.
Love, L-O-V-E. And my birthday is on Valentine's Day, February 14th, 2000. Usually when I wake up at 5-ish in the morning to drop my mom off, she works two jobs at both Providence and Regional Hospital. And when I go to school, you know, I just have my 6-period schedule where it's comprised of AP classes like AP Lang, AP US History, AP Psychology. At the end of the day, I'll either be on my way to work, or if it's one of those days where I'm in a production, then I go straight to rehearsal and then work. I loved watching movies as a little kid. I'd watch them repeatedly and to a certain extent where I could recite an entire 2-hour movie, you know, by myself, and people would think that's weird, but I thought this was pretty cool. Acting was the only thing that actually made me happy in it. I had true passion and guidance. I tell my friends and coworkers and even my boss sometimes, I'm like, one day that's gonna be me on the screen. I think the one that really gets to me, just the actor that I really enjoy and love and admired and always admired, is Kenneth Branagh. The way he brings forth, you know, the most tragic Shakespearean characters to even the most modern people, I find really fascinating, and that just gives me some inspiration and to challenge myself and to do complex pieces or monologues like Shakespeare or contemporary work. I'd love to win an Oscar or a Golden Globe or an Emmy or stuff like that, but I don't need it. My true goal as an actor is to continue to learn. And the more knowledge I learn as an actor, the more I want to share it amongst other people. And if that means fame and money and stuff, well, that's fine by me too. You know, just give me the check. That's great. But I'm not here for the money. I'm not here for the awards. I'm here for the craft. I'm here for the love and appreciation for art.
Xavier Love lives in Anchorage. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Emily Kwong and Wesley Early. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. Have a great weekend. I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
At Alaska Pacific University, students are surrounded by beauty, distinguished faculty, and independent-minded creative students pursuing higher education. AlaskaPacific.edu, moving life forward with APU. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.